It's nice to hear the sound of the rain. So I'm supposed to try to be more eloquent than the rain is. Let's see if that happens. Or not, and just share a little dharma, see what comes. I was wanting to say a few words, at least in the direction of lawfulness, and the lawfulness of things, and seeing the rain fall. Just thinking how we'll, depending on our likes, our preferences, we might, you know, like the rain, or maybe feel brings on some melancholy or sadness. But rain falls because of all the appropriate conditions have come together, and the rain falls. In the groups today and yesterday, kind of part of what's been the way my mind's been taking in people's sharings is a little bit, it feels like reality is showing up. Reality is knocking. I don't know if you happen to like the particular guests that are knocking on your door right now. And it's up to you whether or not you open the door or not. But the lawfulness of conditions of life, that things will happen, right? Things will happen if the appropriate conditions are in place. This moment arises. Right now we are 40-some of us in here, and there are an infinite number of causes and conditions that have come together for this precise moment to happen. The Buddha said that it was not necessary to trace back in time to try and figure out why any particular thing arises. He says that's actually a pretty quick way of going insane, is to try and figure out everything about what's causing something to arise. What's arising? Which is a relief. So that's not part of what's necessary to be free. So we don't have to figure out everything that's involved. But this perspective of lawfulness really is essential. Does this sound okay? If what is happening right now in your own heart, your own body, were random, had no causes that were lawful, there'd be nothing that we could actually traverse as a path. There'd be no pathway to understanding. Things would just be haphazard. Rain would fall on sunny days. It would be sunny on cloudy days. That'd be nice. And it's not going to happen. Maybe when the clouds break. Now, I remember before I came onto the path of the Dharma, I didn't know it, but I was desperately trying to figure out a way through suffering. You know, I thought a lot of my decisions were, you know, based in other reasons, some deep passion or conviction or love or something. I was like being driven either in career or choices in life. But the more I've grown in the Dharma, the more I've seen that actually so much of small decisions and big ones are this attempt, this effort to be okay, to be content and happy. It was a surprising source of relief to hear that suffering has a cause. And so in the Dharma we say that causes are clear for suffering. And our normal perspective, of course, as we've been sharing with you, is we tend to blame or point our finger to something, some object, some experience. It might be something that is external to us, a person, a situation, a story, something that might happen in the future, some discomfort of the body as it ages, illness and sickness, death, or things that have happened in our past, lost loved ones or difficult events, painful events. And then there's all the host of internal experiences that we are familiar with by being mindful also of difficult states of mind, emotions, moods, body experiences. And yet, any cause, any suffering at all, when we really begin to look and open to it, it's amazing. But there is some cause, and that cause is in the mind, those conditions. So I'm really talking about the Four Noble Truths here. The first two of the Noble Truths are that suffering is part of this living process. There is suffering. And that it has a cause, is the second Noble Truth. I find it an enormous relief to know that even though I might not be able to know in the moment what's the source of my suffering or my predicament, that there is something that's discoverable. Something I can begin to feel into and recognize. What's going on here? What is it? What's the movement of my mind and heart right now that is contributing to this sense of disturbance or agitation? In the world of science and the universe, we've discovered so many laws in physics, chemistry, astrophysics. We can do extraordinary things now with the physical world. And in a way, I would say our technological advances seem to be outpacing our moral or spiritual development. You know, when we come into the Dharma, part of what we're doing is placing ourselves in the middle, in the center of the lawfulness of experience, of consciousness. We're not needing to create anything. We're not making things happen. So one of the reasons why we've been encouraging these flavor, this attitude of relax, just be natural, open, learn. Just because everything we need to know about the nature of this mind and heart is available to us. When we're given the gift of the Dharma, I think it was Bhikkhu Bodhi who said, and then there's only two things that are required for suffering to come to an end, something like that. And he said it's to begin the journey and to not stop. I would also say maybe don't sprint, because it's a long haul. But if we begin and we keep going, and lessons are being learned, and the rain keeps falling, the rain of awareness, moment after moment. The lawfulness of the mind. Always arising and passing away. Always arising, passing away. New moments. We say there's momentum or a legacy from one moment to another. That's why moods stay for a while. They don't just zing around all over the place. There's some momentum one moment to another, but they're new moments. They sometimes appear conceptually as permanent and solid, but it's new arisings, new moments. So when we understand that that's the nature of the mind, we can really understand why it's so important for awareness to be established in a natural way. The more moments that awareness is present, the more it'll condition another moment to be aware. And the more moments that we are not aware, guess what? I remember telling Joseph Goldstein, who was reporting to him at one point, off retreat in daily life, and remarking to him how amazing it was, how my wisdom seemed to grow so much on retreat. But I had been complaining a little bit before that also about kind of just the drudgery of life and the difficulty. So he's like, guess what? If you don't practice, your wisdom will get weaker. And I hadn't really, really considered that. I sort of thought it was like a kind of it notches up, that as long as you keep notching it up, it'll stay there. And it's like, great, now I'm this wise. But actually, it's amazing. Even being here, and I'll feel like if I'm steadier and there's more momentum, oh, the mind is clearer. There's more right view coming into the mind. We call wisdom, right? It's knowing things as they are. 5 minutes after the retreat, I see that first ping of delusion, and that's like, well, here we go. Back into habits. So learning how to take in practice as a lifestyle. And we've opened up the container today so that you can explore that. What is it that inspires me to be aware? or what reminds me to be aware. I often ask myself, how much suffering do I need to experience before I want to be aware again? It's like, it takes a while to learn our lessons. Another relieving aspect of considering the lawfulness of experience. It helps me to really feel like it's okay. This is okay. It's okay that I'm experiencing this moment. It's okay. Speaking particularly about when it becomes difficult or unpleasant. Those times where the mind feels agitated or uncertain or doubtful, irritated. Conditions are here for this to arise. I might not see all the conditions, all the causes that are coming together. But if I remember that this is part of being human, and part of being in a lawful world, okay, it's like this. It's like this right now. And because understanding and wisdom, clarity, is also conditioned, it's also lawful. We can't make these things happen. And we can take care of what is within our capacity. In the seven factors of enlightenment, the seven factors that are really very beautiful mind states, that come together when there's a lot of momentum. We say those first three of mindfulness, of interest and investigation, and of energy or effort. That those are causes that we can put in. We have some capacity to put those seeds in. Right? So we're dropping in moments of mindfulness. Anytime we're forgetting, we can prompt ourselves again, or we see someone else walking mindfully and that inspires the mind. So, all right, what's happening here? We put in these seeds of mindfulness, which brings in some energy or some interest. Can I get close to my own experience? What's happening? It's almost like the last thing that sometimes we can come to know is the very filter of our own mind and heart that precedes what it is that we take in from the world. And the Dharma has this very deep intimacy that I think it invites us towards, is being so close to what's happening. So close, not afraid to recognize what's going on, not afraid to feel, to open. It's like being invited into one's own heart again, one's own system, to fully occupy it. The first couple years of my practice, I would say I was really operating out of strong habits of doing, of controlling. And the particular particular technique that I was, or the way I was interpreting it, was like a top-down, you know, watching my body sensations, and you know, I was becoming very clear and aware, but there was still some ways that I was, I'd say, removed from really being fully open, kind of in my own experience. And after those years, I was looking for a teacher, and I was in northern India at that time. And after a very fortunate meeting for me, someone had just come from Burma and had been with a teacher named Sri Min Sayadaw, who is Utejaniya's teacher. And she was telling me that, you know, this wonderful teacher had just passed away, but there was this other teacher, Utejaniya, that was young and starting to teach, and that I might enjoy kind of his flavor of natural way of practicing and teaching, and something about that really connected with me. It's like a force that was unstoppable. I knew I was going to go there. So when I went and reported to him those first times, he gave me some sort of instructions. Just open up. He said, your awareness is very strong, but you're controlling too much. Open up. I spent, at least what my memory says now, I spent a couple weeks going to the hall, and it felt like I was just sobbing, letting go, and crying, because it felt as if, really for the first time, I was being invited to know fully what was here. That I had been, in some ways, dismissing parts of my experience as not being valid, not being worth paying attention to, overriding, you know, with my own practice. There's something just life-giving. And it wasn't, not even to do that, not even to create it. It was just, when we stop kind of pushing against the dam, right, of life, or pushing against things, there's just what's happening. There's just life. And it might be that there's some mood in the mind that's just there. It's grumpy. Okay. That's fine. I'm not fighting that. Some view of myself that I've been trying to avoid and get rid of. I don't have to fight that. That's not a struggle. Again, hearing the rainfall, it's like my whole mind had been pushing up to the, you know, to the skies and holding, trying to hold everything back. It's as if I could hold all the raindrops up, you know, if I could just keep it all in place, you know, then things will be okay. So just a little caveat again, which is the importance of balance. So I'm not saying let it all in and flood your mind, because we need the appropriate factors in the mind to learn and to see what's there. And so it's important to be balanced and be able to turn towards the present experience and open to that. But if our practice has been much more about holding things in place, some level of control that maybe has not been observed before, it may be interesting to see, how much do I need to be in charge here? What does it really mean to be in charge? Is it the directing the attention? Controlling the awareness a little bit? Because even the idea of being in charge really is just an idea in the mind that we cling to some part of our experience, our meditative experience, and we try and do it, and we do it right, and do it skillfully. And this image right now of, since I'm talking so much about kind of nature and rain, it's like we're each sitting in our cushion or on our spot, and we're, it's like I see you as a flower, you know, and we're growing, and might not even realize it, but there are all these little seeds that are being planted, and they're growing, and they're growing. Unavoidable, really unavoidable. If we are in an atmosphere where we hear the Dharma frequently, you know, and for a while it's external and it just kind of touches the mind and maybe bounces off, but it touches again, bounces off, or lands in the heart. But if we hear the Dharma frequently, or someone intending to speak truthfully and clearly, and we're with other beings that are tending to their own experience. So with Sangha, good friends that are trying to do their best. So not trying to create havoc, but trying. And it's inevitable that something changes. This is, again, the lawfulness of experience. And when the Buddha, I think, looked into the nature of the mind, it's like looking into the fabric of the universe or into the mechanics of a car engine. But if you can see something really clearly and you know how things work, it's just a matter of putting in the appropriate conditions. One of the ways that Sādhā Uttejaniya describes meditation, you often say it's not you that's practicing. It's really these five spiritual faculties when we have a balanced practice. And just a reminder that those five faculties our faith, our confidence, some sense that, okay, this works. If I pay attention, I seem to know experience more clearly than if I don't pay attention. That something as simple as that can raise the faith, the confidence level. If I just am always distracting myself, okay, yeah, that leads to a different place. So confidence or faith doesn't have to be some explosion of, you know, I want to prostrate full body in front of the Buddha. I've had that kind of faith, and it has totally taken me by surprise because don't think of myself particularly as a faith type. But when you come across some understandings of the mind that someone else has told you about before, it suddenly you realize, wow, I can't believe this thing I've never understood is true. And some strong faith can come. So faith and energy or effort is the second of the five spiritual faculties, mindfulness, steadiness of mind, and wisdom. And I bring those up in the context of lawfulness also, because even this, these faculties, which might seem very separate, they all have their own conditions, and there's also a relationship between those particular qualities of mind that we're using to practice. So when we have some confidence in the practice, some sense that I want to do this, I have some, yeah, this is something I believe is worth doing. And maybe we have someone in our life that inspires us in their practice, or they've gone off for a long retreat, or some teacher that we know. Someone shares their own habits of mind that have changed a result of practice, can feel that energy come up. Wow, that's the result of practice. I know for me, when I've shared that I've been terrified of public speaking, and that for some people that have been conditioned by that fear also, and they then see me facing that particular pattern, you know, it can give them faith. Wow, the mind has a habit that it can look into and that's that deeply entrenched. And I never thought that if I practiced that someday that, you know, my giving a public Dharma reflection could inspire someone, because I was doing something that had been so difficult for me in the past. You know, you never know where your own practice is going to be the inspiration for someone else. Really don't know. It happens all the time, and we may never find out the people that we've touched. So faith is a quality of mind. When there's faith and confidence, it's natural for energy to follow. And I see it when I've lost some faith, and then I try and make myself practice. It's almost like I'm skipping over something. I don't actually value what I'm doing, and I'm just mechanically trying to do something that somehow I feel like maybe I should be. But as soon as I touch in again, I remember, oh yeah, it's valuable to be aware. Maybe it's just being aware of my speech or my action, or just knowing that there's an impact by what I do and say, oh, that's enough. Right? So that brings me some confidence of the Dharma again. So any seed like that can then raise the energy and interest. Right, and this path takes energy. As you know, we're not going to just meet rainbows and unicorns on the path. I do hope it's going to be so. May they all be rainbows and unicorns, camouflaged, you know, behind the dukkha. So maybe inside, that's what's there. So it's going to take energy. It's just, you know, sustaining persistence. And we were talking today in one of the groups about the value of Sangha, and it's one of the things that can, you know, Sangha can really give us is this sustaining power. You know, and for any one of us, be a rare, rare mind that could come on a 9-day retreat and be completely alone without any support at all, really at all. And even reflecting on the Dharma internally oftentimes is a result of previous contact with Sangha. The voice of another, it said, is one of the main causes for right view to arise. So energy, just to finish the train of where I was going, that when there's energy for the practice, and we can show up again, we're here, we're present, being mindful of what's arising, being awake, knowing. And this is, I'd say, really one of the heart of what the Buddha was offering as a practice for us. A meditation practice is wakefulness, being awake, knowing. And each moment that we do drop in a moment of recollecting, and it can seem pointless. Why on earth is it going to make a difference if I know that I'm feeling cold air come in my nose? It's like, you know, when I had really strong doubt storms, I'm like, oh my God, I've completely joined a cult. Because why on earth is this effective? We're watching the sensations right on my butt. Why is that onward leading? But it is. It is onward leading. Right? If we're aware of the cool air or the pain in the butt, that's dispelling delusion. It's a moment free of delusion. If we're clearly knowing something, it's a moment that has dispelled, we say, the darkness of delusion, of not knowing. And that is conditioning another moment of mindfulness, of wakefulness. You know, I can sometimes get caught in a mood that feels endless. But increasingly, having a mood mindfully, even if it's something, you know, very unpleasant, I feel the transformative nature of it. And I really can feel very clearly now that the mind is growing in awareness even while this difficult state is here. So don't underestimate, if you have a tendency to, the value of just recognizing what state you're in. There may still be a lot of clinging and identification to it, but transformation is happening. That's how it happens. And we're noticing. And those moments of noticing lead to stability. As Andrea was saying, that we connect, or in one moment of awareness after another, is really the source of samadhi, stability of mind. And we're a couple days in now, 3 days in. You might not recognize it yourself, so I'm not asking you to measure it. But I'm sure on your behalf that the mind is steadier. And I think sometimes we're judging our practice by what we're seeing, forgetting that now we're actually seeing a lot more. And it's that seeing that frees the mind. What we see doesn't have to be what we consider free. That can be just as it is. But we see, aware, moment after moment. So as the mind is steadier, doesn't have to escape, avoid, and we start to be with things. We can see things. We might notice the impermanence of a state of mind, impermanence of sensations. Might have an insight into the difference between really being identified with an experience and beginning to be able to step back and observe it. Oh, right. Oh, this is what this is. I'm able to get my hands around this experience, and I can see this now. It's like some patterns of mine. I remember discussing with one yogi on the long retreat. They were sharing how they don't understand why they keep choosing the path of suffering. It's almost like deciding to put the head like in the toilet bowl and then just sitting there and flushing it. It's like, but seeing that that's what I'm doing, was like, why do we do that? And then slowly we're coming in and, you know, getting another report saying, yeah, I seem to be flushing the toilet again on my head, and it seems like that's a very strange thing to do. Of course, none of us, I hope you're not doing that literally, of course, but in a way, figuratively, in some sense, that's what dukkha is. Some pattern that we haven't yet understood that the mind is engaged in, and we keep kind of flushing ourselves into this process, and it's very agitating. It's unpleasant. That's dukkha. Now, obviously, if one could see a pattern as clearly as putting one's head in the toilet and flushing it, it would be so easy to be free of suffering, because none of us would choose to do that. Right? So none of us are choosing our suffering, but our mind is doing it. Habits of mind, getting entangled, not seeing clearly, taking a view and a perspective that doesn't see the Dhamma, and the mind reacts. And that's all that's happening. So patterns for me that were impossible to see. And I thought, now this experience equates suffering for me. But slowly, it was like thread by thread, I could see how a thought based in maybe some view of myself, what should happen, what shouldn't happen, what I liked, what I didn't like, all of that would get entangled and create this bundle of experience that then I would be at the mercy of, and it would be overwhelming for my mind. But they're all threads that are knowable. And they're all conditions that are happening. And again, it's not that we need to figure any of this out. I've never been able to figure out anything kind of willfully. And I spent a while now trying to undo some patterns, and there's plenty of patterns that I'm at times trying to, you know, accelerate the process of getting out of my system. And that's impossible, right? That's not the way something gets understood. And the way anything will find its own completion is because we're willing to be with it. We're there, we're observing it. As Andrea is saying, it's like being a naturalist of our own heart, our own mind. Can we get interested in our own experience enough that we can see something, anything? And this kind of retreat environment really has some unique characteristics because it's more open. There's so much more potential to see kind of personality tendencies come out internally, you know, just watching the mind, you know, judging or comparing, watching ourselves, you know, move throughout the day. Not to overlook that. There's so much richness to understand. When we really learn how to be mindful of ourselves in a natural way in this kind of context, then in life when we go home, it feels so available. So available. And we're not then kind of relating to our practice as something that we've got to get to, some state I'm trying to get to. But what's here? What's here? What's here? It's very real. Real and it's ordinary. You know, so these very ordinary moments, allow them to build and collect momentum, dropping in the awareness, being with whatever state is here, and seeing a change. When we close out the last few minutes, continuing to sit together. Thank you for your practice. Continue practicing.